This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear how craft beer is creating spin-off businesses in Kalamazoo. But first, it was 10 years ago this fall that the Kalamazoo Promise was first announced. The scholarship program covers up to 100% of tuition and fees at any community college or state university in Michigan for graduates of Kalamazoo Public Schools. This year's graduating class is the first that can take advantage of the expansion to include many private schools in Michigan, including Kalamazoo College. A new study from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research finds that the promise is helping more of those students attend and ultimately graduate from college. Two of the study's three authors are joining us. Tim Bardick is in studio, and Brad Hirschbein is on the phone from Washington, D.C., where he's currently a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So what does your study show in terms of how much difference it makes that a student has been eligible for the Kalamazoo Promise and used it in determining whether or not they're going to go to college and ultimately get a degree?
Well, I think the big bottom line headline from this is that it increases the chances of a student getting any post-secondary credential, whether that's an associate's degree or a bachelor's, by one-third. And it also increases the chances of a student getting a bachelor's degree by about one-third. So, for example, we estimate that a comparable group in the pre-promise period would have had a 36% chance of getting any post-secondary credential within 6 years, and that 48% of the eligible group after the promise gets a post-secondary credential within 6 years. So that 36% and increased to 12% to 48%, that's a one-third increase. And we also find a one-third increase for bachelor's degrees. In fact, most of that credential effect is due to an increase in bachelor degrees due to the promise.
As opposed to associate's degree that someone might get from a community college.
Right, that goes up some, but on net, well, probably there are some people who switched from being high school graduates to being associate degrees, and some people switched from being associate degrees to bachelor degrees, and so the net effect on associate degrees ends up being somewhat smaller as a result.
And in fact, that's general, more of a phenomenon. We find that there is an upgrading, that students who would have gone to Kalamazoo Valley Community College, the local two-year college, are now going to a four-year university, and that's probably driving a lot of the effects we find in bachelor's degrees.
How exactly did you do the study? How do you control for all of the variables which can be surrounding this? And I realize we may be going down the rabbit hole a little bit of research techniques, but I think people kind of want an idea of how exactly you got at these numbers.
Well, the promise, since it's a universal program, you couldn't set it up as a random assignment experiment. But it is a natural experiment to an extent because there is an eligible group, the group that's started attending school since at least ninth grade. And there's an ineligible group that starts after ninth grade, 10th grade or after. And we essentially follow those two groups before and after the promise. And we look at the changes over time in those two groups from before and after the promise. And we now have, the reason the study is coming out now is we finally have enough data to actually say what's happened in the post-promise period as of 6 years after high school graduation for several cohorts of graduates. So we're essentially looking at the changes over time for the eligible group versus the ineligible group before and after the promise. And from that, we can ascertain effects. And what we observe is that there are no real pre-existing or post-time trends for the two groups. And in the year the promise was announced, there's this abrupt shift where all of a sudden the eligible group, their success, their attendance rate, and then ultimately their success rate at college pops up compared to the ineligible group. And the most natural explanation of that is that it's an effect of the promise, or specifically the promise's tuition scholarships and whatever else is associated with that.
If we look at the numbers and we break them down, are there differences in terms of the effects, or do we find differences in terms of different income levels, in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of the benefit of the promise? Does that show up?
That was one of the surprising things going in, is that we didn't know what the effects, if the effects were going to be different for those different groups. I, for one, had a suspicion that it might be just the more affluent students, the more well-to-do students, who would benefit the most, that they would just go to a slightly more expensive college, but they probably would have graduated college anyhow. And that would mean that overall, maybe college completion wouldn't go up, because some students, money isn't always everything. You need to have the academic capability of actually getting through college. And so we were actually kind of pleasantly surprised that the effects turned out not to vary that much by income status, whether the students were on free or reduced price lunch, which is our proxy for whether they're lower income. The effects were very quite similar, not statistically significantly different at all. The effects, are, if anything, were stronger for non-white students who also tend to be more economically disadvantaged, especially in Kalamazoo. The one thing that was not quite as positive is that the effects do seem to be concentrated almost entirely for female students, and we found basically very little effect on completion for male students. Although they were more likely to attend, that didn't translate into a later completion that was on the women.
You say in this report that, if anything, the estimates about the effects of the Kalamazoo Promise are conservative. Why do you say they're conservative?
Well, they're conservative in several respects. One of the reasons is that since we're comparing the eligible versus ineligible group before and after the Promise, we're not allowing really for a lot of the effects of the Promise have been the whole school system and the whole community mobilizing to try to make this extraordinary opportunity, this extraordinary program, more successful. So people are trying to change the climate of the schools so that it promotes going to college and succeeding in college. Now, if they're doing that, you would expect that to also benefit the ineligible students. You also might think there might be peer effects. If more of my peers are talking about going to college, maybe that induces me to think about going to college. So we're not really capturing any of those community-wide effects in our estimates. We're really focusing much more on simply providing the scholarships, which is the real difference between the eligible and the ineligible students.
Would the other things perhaps fall under the category of intangibles, things that are very difficult to measure, if not impossible to measure?
Well, the only way you could really do it, I suppose, if someone wanted to take 100 communities and randomly assign 50 to have a universal promise program and the other 50 not to, I suppose we could capture some of these intangible community effects. Otherwise, it'd be very difficult. But I think they're real. I think they're important. I think what people are doing to try to change the climate of the schools is an important aspect of what the Promise is trying to do. It's simply something that we can't capture in our focus on what happens to the eligible versus ineligible students over time.
Right, and we do discuss that a little bit more in the paper, and we want to emphasize that the effects we're finding, we can't say that they're just due to the money. The fact that students have gradually learned to know that the money is always going to be there, it's waiting for them, that changes their own behavior, even going back into middle school or even elementary school. And so a one-off scholarship versus something that students know is going to be permanently there can be very, very different. And that's something that, as other communities are thinking about this, they should keep in mind.
This is, of course, a report prepared by economists. So you have a cost-benefit component, which is factored in here, about, you know, what is the benefit in terms of the dollars spent on scholarships to what we see in terms of the broader economy. What do you find in terms of the investment, which I guess we could call it, being made by these anonymous donors and what it's producing?
Well, I should emphasize these are projections, and we would like eventually to take our study and link up the data with actual earnings data. But we know from numerous studies that more education is correlated with higher earnings. So if you simply take the increased bachelor's credentials due to the Promise that we estimate, the increased associate degrees due to the Promise, and project the future increase in earnings of these individuals, you come up with a conclusion that you can put in different ways, but essentially for every dollar of Promise scholarship costs, the present value of earnings goes up by $4, a 4-to-1 ratio. Or another way to put it is, if the Promise was viewed as an investment where we were investing and the returns were the increased earnings, this would be an investment with over an 11% annual rate of return, which far exceeds what you can get in the stock market. Now, I should emphasize that economists were supposed to be cold-blooded. Doesn't mean the only thing that counts in the universe is earnings. I mean, obviously, there are benefits of education that go well beyond the personal earnings of the individuals involved. There are benefits for their children. There are benefits in terms of voting. There are effects of education on civic behavior. We know that. We know that there may be spillover benefits for the economy. When some people get more skills, this may have spillover benefits on the wages of other workers. So I think these benefit cost estimates are actually conservative, that more education has bigger payoffs than we're actually estimating.
There are some other communities which have developed some sort of place-based scholarship program. There are lots of different ways they've done it. They're not all exactly like the Kalamazoo Promise. Does your study give a little more weight to someone who is making their case in another community somewhere in the United States that, hey, we should follow Kalamazoo's model? Do you think it makes the case for someone who wants their own place-based scholarship program?
I think it certainly does for an urban school district. For an urban school district that would have similar demographics to KPS, if you adopt a scholarship program that is simple and generous, which is what the Kalamazoo Promise is, not a lot of hoops to jump through, then I think this strongly indicates that this will have some big payoffs, not only in terms of maybe attracting enrollment, which is something that Brad and I have studied in the past, or improving high school behavior, but in improving post-secondary success and ultimately life success for the students involved. It doesn't necessarily mean that anything that is labeled a Promise scholarship program, I mean, if the program has a 3.5 GPA requirement and the only benefit it provides is you can go to the local community college for 1 year and you call that a Promise scholarship, well, it might be a good program, but I would expect that to have less of an effect because students with a 3.5 GPA are probably already going mostly to college, so you wouldn't think there'd be much differential effect. So putting in a lot of additional requirements and hoops to jump through changes the program in some fundamental ways from the model in Kalamazoo, so I'd be very hesitant to generalize to very different models of scholarships.
Fortunately, we're also, the Upjohn Institute is part of a broader consortium that's studying other Promise programs that do differ from Kalamazoo's in terms of how generous they are and the types of students that qualify. For instance, by including merit requirements or financial need requirements. Most of those other Promise programs aren't quite far along enough in existence yet so that they can kind of do the same type of analysis we did in looking at college completion. As we've talked about, we need a few more years of data to do that, but the hope and the goal is that we will be able to analyze what are those differences in those types of programs and how much of a difference it makes in terms of the effectiveness of the program. So we hopefully in a few years will be able to answer that question.
Tim Reddy, who is the director of the Lewis Walker Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnic Relations here at Western Michigan University, had a posting on the Brookings blog. We mentioned that Brad Hirschbein is currently a visiting scholar there. He says, well, the headline is Free College is Not Enough, the Unavoidable Limits of the Kalamazoo Promise. He raises some questions about how much social mobility is being helped by students who are eligible for the Kalamazoo Promise, especially when you factor in race and other factors. What are, as you see them, Tim or Brad, the limits of the Kalamazoo Promise?
Well, if the question is, does the promise solve all problems? If anyone for some reason thought that it doesn't solve all problems. And I don't think that's surprising. It's hard to find any kind of social or educational program that solves all the problems for all the people. I mean, for example, in our findings, we're finding that the percentage of students eligible for the promise who get a post-secondary credential within 6 years goes up from 36% to 48%. That's a big increase, but it's still the case that it's only 48%. There's still another 52%. Now, maybe some of them will be able to get a credential in their remaining eligibility for the promise, but some of them won't. And, presumably that means that the promise was not able to benefit them, at least in terms of post-secondary credential attainment. So I certainly wouldn't quarrel with the need to do other things in K-12 school reform, preschool education, early childhood, trying to increase the number of good jobs, trying to help students complete college through programs to provide support or help to students when they're in college, or, a variety of anti-poverty programs dealing with discrimination in housing, neighborhood conditions. We could go on and on. But the challenge for public policy is not necessarily to try to solve all the problems in one fell swoop, but we need to identify interventions that have a high bang for the buck that work. The Kalamazoo Promise is one such intervention, and then we need to discuss, well, how do we deal with the glass half empty part of the thing? So we found something with a high bang for the buck, but there are problems that remain, and how do we deal with those?
Right. I'd just like to echo that clearly there's no silver bullet. And what we've demonstrated is that in some cases, the promise helps close the gap, but a good chunk of that gap still remains. And many of the other programs that Tim mentions are some of which are already being implemented, a few others of which would probably be beneficial, are going to be necessary to close that gap further. But as Tim also mentioned, anything that helps us close that gap and does so in a cost-effective manner is something that both Kalamazoo and other similar communities should be interested in pursuing.
From a research standpoint, what's next? I mean, is there another aspect of the Kalamazoo Promise that that you see as being ripe for examination, whether it's by you or by other researchers? Do you see things out there that that another team or maybe this team should take a look at?
So one of the things that the donors were originally interested in when they began the promise, it wasn't just to get people to go to college, but it was more of a broader effort to revitalize the community. And that's hard to quantitatively measure, which is generally what economists do, because a lot of the things that show up aren't things that regularly get tracked in terms of numbers, or it's very hard to track them. And that could be things like people moving into the community. It could be new businesses being started. It could be people feeling more optimistic about the broader community. It's the signs and the banners that fly from various lampposts around Kalamazoo. It's the signs in people's yards that say, this is a promised school, which realtors use to great effect. Yep. All those sorts of things we can't quite capture very readily in a data set that we can then analyze and crunch the numbers, but they definitely matter. And one of the ways that we think we can perhaps tap into that in the near future is trying to figure out where the Kalamazoo graduates, the Kalamazoo Promise graduates actually go if they do finish, if they do go to school. Are they staying in the area? Are they contributing their educational gains to the broader community? And so we can hope to tie that in by following them a little bit further out past their education and once they begin their work lives and seeing what types of things they're doing. And so we are going to try to pursue that in the next few years.
Right. And then I'm also doing some research trying to see if we can detect in promise-style programs any aggregate effects on the economy and in-moving behavior. And I should say that we do find some promising things both in this study and previous studies. Brad has done some previous research finding that there are some effects of the promise causing some people either to come to Kalamazoo from outside the state or who would have otherwise moved outside the state, staying in Kalamazoo public schools and looking at kind of a movement of families in and out of the schools. And then in this particular study, one of the interesting findings is we find, as you might expect, a substitution of promise-eligible schools for non-promise-eligible schools for the eligible group before and after the promise. Where they go to college changes. There's a big increase for promise-eligible schools, and there's a smaller decrease for promise-ineligible schools. And when you break that down a little bit, most of the decrease for promise-ineligible schools is not due to private colleges going down, because during this period, private colleges weren't eligible. It's due to out-of-state schools going down. So to the extent to which the promise is inducing some students to stay in Michigan universities and colleges, you might guess that that would cause people to be more likely to end up living in Michigan.
Tim Bardick and Brad Hirschbein, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Bardick joined us in studio, and Brad Hirschbein joined us by phone. They are two of the three authors of a new report from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. It shows an increase in college graduation rates since the beginning of the Kalamazoo Promise. A link to the study can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The explosion of the craft beer industry in Kalamazoo has been good news for the breweries, which are operating and opening in the city. It's also been good for their thirsty customers. But a recent article for Southwest Michigan's Second Wave shows us that craft beer is also leading to spin-off businesses in Kalamazoo. Jeremy Martin is the craft brew writer for Southwest Michigan's Second Wave. Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Gordon.
What made you want to write about this subject in particular?
Well, it's just another extension of what's happening in craft beer in Kalamazoo and in the surrounding area as well. you know, people in this city and in Michigan, and I'm finding actually throughout the country, are, as you had mentioned, thirsty for craft, for something handmade, something that they can't just go to Walmart and purchase. They want something either made for them or something that represents them and the area they come from. And that has really been the underlying ethos with craft beer ever since it reemerged in the late 80s, is it's been tied to place, it's been tied to artistry and in craft in general. And now people are really taking to that, and they want that in their other products. They want that in soaps. They want that in their clothing. They want that in experiences as well, such as brewery tours. They want love put behind the products and the experiences that they have, and they want it to be tied to something that they can appreciate and that they can grasp.
You start your story by asking, what do a bar of soap, a walking tour, and a feature-length film all have in common? And you tell us that each one was created because of and in support of the local craft beer industry. So let's work backwards. What about that feature-length film?
Yeah, so that's a really neat idea. That was done by Rhino Media and headed up by a really cool gentleman named Kevin Romeo. He's from Kalamazoo here. Rhino Media does a lot of promotions and publicity work for local breweries, among other places, though they work with a lot of the community. They also do wedding videos and basically any kind of multimedia websites and that sort of thing. But as I was talking with Kevin, he had basically said, do we want to be known as a company that works for hire, or do we want to make our own content? And as he juggled that idea, the first thing that popped into his mind is craft beer. We want to be involved with craft beer, and we want to tell the story of the beer in general, but also of how it's helped build the city back up. And with their contacts within the brewing industry in Kalamazoo and the greater community, they were able to put together really what turned out to be the first full-length feature documentary on craft beer in Michigan. And it's been a neat thing. It's really taken off outside of Kalamazoo. It had showings at theaters all across the state. You can find it on the internet. They're selling the DVD with commentary. Breweries have done showings of it. And it's neat. And Kevin even told a story about a guy up in UP who saw the film, wasn't really sure what he wanted to do with his life, but all of a sudden, just like that, like a light bulb went off, knew that whatever it was going to be in Kalamazoo, it was going to be with craft beer, and he ended up moving down here and getting a job with Michigan Mobile Canning, which is a company that, as it sounds, goes around to the breweries and helps them can and distribute their beer. So it's another amazing thing that is, it was a fun project for this company to work on, and all of a sudden it's bringing people to Kalamazoo and tying a community together even tighter. It's just neat to look at.
So how about the walking tour?
Yeah, so that was set up by West Michigan Beer Tours, which is John Liberty, formerly of the Kalamazoo Gazette, and Eric Faber, good friend of ours. It's a spinoff of their craft beer tour business, where they either are for hire for companies, weddings, different groups of people, or they set up individual tours that you can buy a spot on. And they drive around in a really, really nice luxury coach and go brewery to brewery. Sometimes they'll do West Michigan. Sometimes they'll head east towards Detroit and Ann Arbor. They've gone to Tiger Games. They've gone to Chicago. They've gone up north. But this idea is new this summer, and what they're doing, and they're also doing a bike tour, which is really neat now that the new pop-up bike lanes are in. So what they're doing is taking people around to the downtown Kalamazoo breweries, and there's 8 breweries downtown Kalamazoo right now, with a 9th popping up once Bright Eyes opens just down Burdick. And so not only are they giving people backstage tours of all the breweries, showing off the different styles of beer, but they're giving a historical context to it as well and showing off Kalamazoo in its historical context. And that's one of the things I mentioned in the story is now we're not just known for education in guitars, it's also beer. Well, they show off the education and the guitar making, and they go by the old Gibson plant, and they talk about the Celery City and about flavoring plants and paper making and the whole history of Kalamazoo in industry is shown off throughout this tour, along with architecture and famous people. I think they stop by one of the graveyards and show off, you know, different spots of well-known former residents. And it's just neat. You're able to really understand the history of the city and become a part of it while also drinking some really, really amazing beer.
So is Kalamazoo becoming better known now for beer than it is for those other things you mentioned, you know, free college and guitars? And I guess I'm also wondering if now maybe craft beer is in some ways tied back to some of the other things which have happened in Kalamazoo related to innovation.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Kalamazoo for a long time has been known as a place where people can come, and it's, I like to call it the West of the Midwest. You know, people come to Kalamazoo and sort of reinvent themselves and become part of a new scene, and it's all about arts and creativity in this city, and it has been for a long time. And yeah, craft beer plays right into that. And it's yes, we are becoming known as a craft beer capital, but I think you hit the nail on the head. It's just an extension of everything else we've done in this city. It just shows off our innovativeness and the fact that we're resilient. And yeah, we were absolutely demolished by a tornado in 1980, and we had recession issues, and you know, buildings didn't boom the way that we had hoped they would. But everyone has bounced back, and we found new things to get involved in. And craft beer is part of that, and so is wine and cider and now film and music and it all ties together.
And then back one more time to the lead of your story. How does a bar of soap work into all of this?
Well, people have to look good. They've got to be clean if they want to go out, right?
Sure.
So Damn Handsome Grooming Company, what they do is they make soap, they make grooming products, they make shaving cream, lotion, all sorts of really, really neat things, and they do it from spent brewing ingredients. Not entirely, of course, but they use hops and malts and barleys to accent their products, both to give them, you know, excellent, both for the smell, for the aesthetic of it, but also for the cleansing properties that the plants have, which is neat. And they've worked with the breweries to take away some of their spent grains and some of their used hops. And they've developed this really, really nice relationship with a lot of the brewers in town. And I was speaking with them about selling their products as well. And I said, you know, a lot of the breweries have their own little brewery stores where they sell T-shirts and beer and swag and that sort of thing. I asked, do you get your products in those stores? And they're very hesitant to put their products in those company stores because they don't want to step on other people's turf as well. They understand that that retail setting is purely for the brewery's profit.
So as you mentioned, we are on the cusp of having 9 breweries in Kalamazoo. Lots of people have wondered, I think, over the years, at some point, is Kalamazoo going to hit peak beer? And I guess I'm wondering from these spinoff businesses, do they think about that in the back of their minds, that at some point this is not going to be as sustainable as it's been so far?
That's absolutely a question on a lot of people's mind, and there is no definitive answer to that. It's always been I guess we'll cross that bridge when we get to it point. But, I mean, some things to really consider are there are over 3,000 breweries in this country alone right now, but we're still not at pre-prohibition levels of small breweries. At the turn of the century, in the 19th into the 20th, there were over 4,000 breweries in this country. And there were only 75 million people and 2 fewer states. There are a lot more people in this country right now. I think, 320 million people or something like that in the United States, and 1,000 breweries less than there were in 1900. So the question of when the bubble will break, I think we still have a while to go.
Jeremy Martin, thank you very much for your time.
Well, of course. Thanks, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Martin is the craft brew writer for Southwest Michigan's Second Wave. You can find a link to the Southwest Michigan's Second Wave article, Craft Beer Spawns Lots of Little and Growing Businesses, at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.